Thanks for joining us for this Views and Brews podcast, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. We hope you enjoy the show. So I was going to start with risk tonight because we're going to be talking about the psychology of risk. But Art said, you know, we should really start with reinvention. And I was like, well, I will just reinvent the whole evening and we will start with that instead. But how many of you, I mean, it's a great time to talk about reinvention because it's a new school year and it's fall and I feel like things kind of, you know, remake themselves in fall. How many of you have in one time in your life reinvented yourself or had to reinvent yourself? Oh, this is fantastic. So let's start with, I guess I should introduce you guys. I just take for granted that everybody knows who you are, but maybe they don't. So I'm Rebecca McEnroe with KUT, and thank you. And here with me tonight, we have, and I do, because I wanted to make sure people know that, I mean, besides everything they do, this one man is the director of the program in the Human Dimensions of Organization and author of the forthcoming Bring Your Brain to Work, Dr. Art Markman. When that comes out, we'll have a big book launch for that here at the Cactus, so that'll be fun. And we have the Marlene and Morton Meyerson Centennial Professor, also the head of music and human learning here at UT, Dr. Bob Duke. Welcome. Otherwise known as Two Guys on Your Head.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So let's start with reinvention. Why talk about the psychology of reinvention? What does it entail?
Well, I think the first thing to say is the ultimate invention, of course, is birth. And we have a birthday boy here tonight.
That's right. So,
ladies and gentlemen. And we will talk a little bit later. This is a placeholder for this. We talk a little bit later about how we often use landmarks like birthdays as a way of assessing where we are in life to decide whether some kind of reinvention might be required.
Yeah, tell me about it.
So thank you for having a birthday today so that we could segue
that.
Into
okay,
that
yeah.
gracefully. But one of the things to get started is to think about the fact that all of us walk around with some set of beliefs about who we are. And those beliefs form what is typically called a self-concept. And there's lots of different dimensions of it. And I'm gonna start with one, and then we can pile on a few others and then think about how you might change them. But one of the interesting dimensions of people's self-concept is the degree to which you think of yourself relatively independently of other people or interdependently with other people. And so if we were to ask you to describe yourself, just come up with, say, 20 different descriptors of yourself. And there is, in fact, a test called the 20 statements test, which does just that. It just says, I want you to give 20 different answers to the question, who am I? And if you look at the kinds of things that people write, some of the things that people write are descriptions of themselves that don't require thinking about other people in order to understand that. So if somebody said, I'm smart, or I'm tall, or something like that, well, that's really describing some characteristic of who you are, as opposed to someone who says, well, I'm a parent or a teacher. And when you say something like that, if you're a teacher, it assumes the presence of a student, the existence of some student. And if you're a parent, it assumes the existence of a child. And so one of the aspects of your self-concept that I think influences who you think you are and can be a dimension for this kind of reinvention is the degree to which you think of yourself in relatively independent or interdependent terms. Because one of the things that can happen to people over the course of their lives is that they can start out, for example, very independent in the way they think of themselves and gradually reinvent themselves in a way that makes them much more interdependent with the people around them.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because all of us who spend our lives interacting with human beings, which I assume is just about everybody, knows that our behavior varies depending on the context in which we find ourselves. And I think one of the reasons that Rebecca astutely decided this would be a good time of year to do a thing on reinvention, and that Art was astutely thinking that we should put this at the front of the thing tonight. Is it at the beginning of new opportunities to meet new people who haven't yet formed impressions about you, there is an opportunity to create impressions that match your aspirations for who you are. I mean, there are a lot of people in all of our lives who've known us for a long time, and they know all the crap that's in our lives. And we meet new people, and there's an opportunity to, they don't know any of that, right? They know what we put forward as our aspirational selves. And I want to emphasize, I'm not talking about doing something that's deceptive or anything like that, right? I mean, all of us, I think, have aspirations that are greater than the reality of who we actually are. I think I saw some bumper sticker that said, "Lord, please help me to be the person my dog thinks I am." So, which I think is a nice thing, you know. But I think for all of us, you know, we would like to be a certain way, and we would like to be perceived by a certain way. And I think the opportunity to be in a new circumstance and meeting new people, all of our students who have now arrived on campus, many of whom are here for the first time, have an opportunity to say, well, this is who I am to the people whom I meet. Now, again, that's not necessarily a negative thing, because, of course, we have ways that we'd like to be perceived by other people. And what's interesting about it is often when we present those ways to other people and people respond to us in response to those things, is that it actually influences the way we become. I often tell my students, I surround myself with skillfully manipulative people who love me. Right? Because they share my values, and my hope is they will manipulate the hell out of me to be better than I deserve to be. Now, that's an interesting thing to think about, because all of us know that in different social circumstances, we're not exactly the same person. You know, we're with some kind of whiny people, and it's easy for us to whine, you know, and we're with some more upbeat people, and it's easier for us to be upbeat. And I think a lot of what we have as opportunities as human beings is to surround ourselves with people and put ourselves in circumstances that make it easier for us to be the kind of people that we aspire to be.
Yeah. And there's this, you know, there's also this element of reinvention, which is a shedding, you know. And I want to talk a little bit about the process of grieving one's own self, you know, before you kind of move on. There was this great interview between Neil Gaiman and Laurie Anderson, and a woman from the audience asked Laurie, you know, I just lost my mom, and it's really difficult for me to find footing. Can you tell me how you find footing in these situations? And Laurie Anderson said, I don't, and I relish these possible, you know, like, it is horrible when you lose someone, but at the same time, you don't get very many opportunities to kind of float and figure out where you're going to land. And so I want to talk about that, the process of grief, letting go, and moving forward.
Yeah. So we've talked a little bit about the concept of grief. And what's interesting is when you juxtapose grief and this idea of reinvention, is that both of them are situations in which you are going to try to make some kind of tear in the fabric of your life. Now, in the case of many grief situations, that happens without without you being able to control it. So the loss of a loved one is something that happens outside of your control. And it may happen suddenly, or it may happen over a long period of time. But in either case, this is not something that you have the opportunity to control. In the case of reinvention, you do have more control over it. But in each case, you are trying to break your life's narrative in a particular moment and make that life's narrative different. In one case, life does that. In the other case, you're trying to do this yourself. And it turns out the narratives that you have about yourself are useful for you to feel like you understand who you are and what your role is in a circumstance. And so one of the things that people who grieve are doing is telling stories to help them to make sense of the situation that they find themselves in. And what's interesting is people who are at the cusp of reinvention do the same thing. They are telling stories, sometimes to themselves, sometimes to the people around them, in which they are trying to create a story that makes coherent why it is that they want to be a different person later than they are right now. And And that is giving yourself that opportunity to tell those stories over and over again, whether you're doing it to other people or to yourself, is an extraordinarily important part of this. And to recognize that throughout that process, you are going to experience a full range of emotions, because change is scary. And one of the things we've talked about a lot on the show is that uncertainty is deeply unsettling for people. And whether you've experienced a loss or you're trying to make a fundamental change in yourself, you are saying that in the future, I'm not going to be able to rely on all of my past experiences to help me understand what's going to happen in the future. And so in those situations, you have to face that uncertainty. That's scary. It's frightening. It's sad. And just one last piece of this, you can see this even in descriptions of change that you think people ought to want to make. So, for example, there's a whole theory in psychology called the stages of change model that was applied first to things like quitting smoking. And you'd think at some level, well, you know, people ought to want to quit smoking. But in fact, there's a whole period of time where someone has a self-concept of being a smoker. They have no intention of quitting smoking. They're not even the least bit interested in it. And if you said to them at that point and gave them all the tools they needed to quit smoking, no way it's going to happen. And then there's another stage where they're thinking, maybe I might kind of sort of potentially someday off into the future quit smoking. And even then, if you give them all the tools to quit smoking, they're not going to do it. And it's only at the point where they actually are able to internalize, yes, I'm ready to be not a smoker, that those tools have any prayer of having an influence. And in some ways, that middle process there is that grieving process that allows you to make that change in self-concept that then makes the various tools for changing behavior effective.
And this speaks to every attempt to change anything. We tend to think, you know, that to be positive about things, we need to have enticing rewards that are waved in front of people, or we wave in front of ourselves, that will motivate us to do something, especially things that are difficult, right? But actually, all the data suggests that that's not the driving force. The driving force is being sufficiently dissatisfied with the status quo, which is what Art was just describing with the smokers. Says, maybe I'd like to quit. You know, that's a different thing from, I gotta stop this, right? Which is a different thing. And I think for us, because change is so difficult, because routine is comfortable and it's comforting and it's secure, precisely because, as we talked about on many shows, we like to be able to predict what's about to happen. And the more predictable the world is, the happier we are. And changing anything introduces unpredictability and uncertainty. And that's not a happy thing, right? So there has to be sufficient dissatisfaction with the way things are to say, well, I'm willing to put up with that little ambiguity that's anxiety producing and discomforting in some ways in order to actually initiate what I need to initiate to make a change.
Yeah. There's one other thing one other element of this, the smoker analogy right away that I want to talk about, which is how important are possibility models in this prospect of reinvention? Like, so much that you say to yourself, you might smoke, but you might think, I'm not a smoker, you know? Mm-hmm. And then that moment when you say, if I keep smoking, I'm going to be a smoker, you know? And like, that's a problem. So then we got to put it away. But also just thinking about like people who you look up to, or just ideas that you are moving toward, and images and other people who you can emulate. How important is that in this process of reinvention?
Well, I mean, I think it can be very important, and we'll take the second part first, and then maybe if we remember, we'll go back to the first part.
But not likely, okay.
But I think you know, it's the thing about creativity and reinvention requires a certain degree of creativity, because you have to imagine what could I be in the future, is that our imagination is deeply limited by our experience. So here's a game you can play at home with a friend. Ask them to draw an alien being. Okay, just say, you know, use your imagination, draw the craziest alien being you can. in all likelihood, that alien being is going to be bilaterally symmetric. Okay, it's going to have, you know, it's going to have pairs of arms and legs. It's probably going to have things that are sort of ear-like and eye-like and nose-like. So it's going to be different than an Earth creature, but, you know, it's not going to be like an orb, you know, that floats in space and you can't interact with it. I mean, it's going to look animal-like, that because our ability to be creative is really limited by the experience that we have. And when we're trying to reinvent ourselves, one of the things that we need is examples of what we could be. And then one other thing, so something that we've talked about on previous shows, is that what's motivating to us isn't just dissatisfaction. That's a big part of it. But dissatisfaction creates energy, but you have to then create direction for that energy. So you have to create what you can think of as a bridgeable gap from present to future. And so the value of having some sort of model out there that can tell you what you might be is that it provides the direction to go along with the energy. Otherwise, you're just dissatisfied with your life. I don't even know what I could do. But when you believe, well, I see these people out there, and they're like me in enough of a way that I think I can do this, then you create energy with direction. And that's one of the reasons why, I know I said I was going to stop, but that's one of the reasons why it's so important to have to have a diverse set of people occupying so many roles. Because we want everyone to be able to look around the world and see people who are like them in important ways that can give people the sense of, yeah, I can do that.
Yeah, and I want to just emphasize and underline a word in what Art just said, and that's the bridgeable gap. That's two words I underline, right? Because for many people, you look at somebody who's, you know, apparently got it all together and you're a mess, and you think, well, I can't be like that person because they're just too far away, right? There are just too many disparities between my own experience and what seems to be their experience, even though it probably isn't. But I don't know that. So I just say, the hell with it. I can't actually even start. And I think one of the things interesting about research in modeling in any dimension of human activity is that we probably intuitively think, well, the best model to look at is an expert model. You know, to see somebody who's just fluent and fluid and perfectly competent and lovely. But actually what we know is that the most advantageous models are so-called learning models, right? Because when you see something that's all going great and everything's cooking and everything looks perfect, you have no idea what are the critical variables that lead to that, right? I mean, you look at people who have it all together and you think, God, they just have it all together. But what you're not seeing is, how do they deal with stuff that doesn't work? You know, how do they confront problems that are seemingly insurmountable? You know, what's their reaction to that? So that dealing with things model is a very different thing than just, you know, somebody who, you know, like Tony Robbins is just like, you know, the world is my oyster and I'm, you know, everything's great and you should be like me. I don't know if that's a good characterization of Tony Robbins, but I don't know. We're probably going to, I know.
Got a cease and desist
letter. I know UT Legal is going to be emailing me tonight, I know. But then,
Bob again.
Yeah, there's that. I need to reinvent that part of myself. But
No. Please don't.
But the notion of this thing about what's a bridgeable gap, you know, I mean, change in any activity, in any dimension of our lives is really hard. I mean, it's really hard. And I think if our goal is only to get from where we are, which we don't like very much, to this sort of perfect, lovely Eden out in the future, we're never going to get there because the distance is too great and it's not bridgeable, to use Art's word. And so after a few moments of effort, we're just going to say to hell with it. We're not going to make it.
And I remembered the first part of your point, so I want to actually say something about it.
Wow, very impressive. Thank you for doing that.
So, because one of the things Rebecca was talking about was the power of labels. So, for example, when somebody says, well, I'm a smoker, why is that more powerful than I'm smoking? Well, we've talked about this a little bit on some previous shows, but the thing about nouns is that when you label something with a noun, it comes along with an essence. And that's the difference between labeling something as a noun and just saying somebody performed a behavior. So there feels like a qualitative difference between a smoker and somebody who's smoking, because the smoker has essence of smoker.
Literally.
Right? There you go. And you can, I often tell people, you can use this as an insult if you want, right? Somebody says, oh, is John a painter? You can say, well, he paints, right? What? And then you can say to people, that insult works because of psychological essentialism. And tell the joke.
We're not advising you to do that,
right,
actually.
Tell the joke and ruin it. In two sentences. So, but now that you know this, you can actually use this powerfully in your attempts to reinvent, because sometimes you may label yourself with something and it can be useful to say, wait a second, I'm just someone who does this thing. Does that make me feel differently about myself? Because if I label myself as having a particular quality, then it seems inevitable that this is what I'm going to do. But if I just say this is a behavior I currently do, now this feels more changeable. And similarly, when you're trying to motivate yourself to do something different, you can actually begin to label yourself with the label you'd like to be, as a way of trying to convince yourself, no, I have essence of this thing, in a way that will drive me to want to continue acting in a way that is consistent with the essence that must be in there somewhere, because this noun now applies.
And that is pretty good, something that we've also talked about on previous shows, and that is the notion that what we do, that is the ways that we behave, are something that wells up from within, from that essence, and then that causes us to make decisions and act in particular ways. When actually, it's the behavior that creates the sense of essence, right? Now, there's an upside to that, right? In that you can choose to behave differently, and through enough repetitions, your essence changes. Right. I mean, so if the idea is, well, I'm, you know, whatever adjective you apply to yourself, and you think that's some immutable aspect of you, and you think, well, why is that? What's the evidence for that? And we would say, well, the evidence is because you do things that are associated with that adjective you use to describe yourself. Well, what if you did things that were representative of a different adjective than that? Well, then, over enough repetitions, people would start thinking of you as that other thing, and so would you. Now, that's not a comfortable feeling for most of us, because most of us feel like there's an essence of us that's embodied in our brains and our souls, whatever, wherever you think you live, right? And that's immutable, and I've got to go now, you know, teach that to do different things, when in fact, that stems from the ways that we regularly behave and make choices that then teaches us what our essence is, right? Now, that's a very powerful potential for a human being to understand in a way that organisms without cognition can't understand that. Because, you know, if you're a pigeon, you're in whatever environment you're in, and that environment leads you to do certain things, and that's all you got because you're a pigeon. But we're human beings, right? And we can choose the environments we put ourselves in. We can choose the people we surround ourselves with. And those environments and those people will make it easier or harder to do things that we want to do, or we want to stop doing, or we aspire to do.
And I sorry, Rebecca.
What else?
One other thing about this aspect of behaving and labeling that I think is important is that we need to focus our attempts at reinvention on things that are actually under our control in some way. So for example, one shouldn't reinvent oneself as a rock star. Because being an actual rock star requires an awful lot of things that are utterly out of your control, right? And I mean, really, you could learn to play an instrument. You could even join a band. But being a rock star is a whole other set of things beyond that. And yet, I think people...
But I want it.
You can create a mental image for yourself of this would be awesome. But I think in many ways you have to stick with
this
what you can
so
do.
This is so sad.
No, I know.
This is
like
so
we're
sad.
Therapy
we're
with
bringing
you.
Everybody down. I know. We need to change the subject.
No,
because you can still do a lot of awesome things,
yeah,
right?
I mean, yeah,
that's
but,
because well, look, here's the
but
problem.
Sting.
If you well, which side is he on?
Oh no!
Oh,
we love Sting.
Okay. All right. But I what I think is important is if you define part of the process of reinvention is that you'd actually like to succeed, and if you define your criteria in a way where you can only succeed if something happens that is monumentally unlikely to ever happen, then you're probably going to spend a lot of your life really disappointed. And I'm not saying aim too low, but I think there's a middle ground there in which you can set a goal for yourself that is achievable and realistic at the same time. So that's where I'm going with this.
And this is coming from a man who decided he was going to be a rock star at like 35 when he right. started to
not
play
a
the
rock
saxophone.
Star. I just wanted to learn to play the saxophone.
And I feel like this is coming to terms with the fact that you won't be a rock star.
I came to terms with that. really, I grieved that.
You all have to go see Phineas Gage whenever you get a chance. That's Art's band. But I want before we leave this idea of reinvention, there's one more aspect I want to talk about, which is the influence of other people in you reinventing yourself and your ability to reinvent yourself. We did a show on why it's so difficult to go home for Thanksgiving, for example, and we started it with, you know, professional by day, 10-year-old by Thanksgiving, back when you're with your family. So the way that you interact with people is very, you know, that's also an element in your ability to reinvent yourself.
Yeah. You know, We are so influenced by the people around us in ways that we are loath to recognize. And you know this, right? There are some people, you hang with them, and you are a different person than when you hang with somebody else. You know, you're upbeat and positive and funny, and then other people you get with, and it's just dark, and you know. and those things are indicative of how susceptible we are to the things that other people reinforce in us and punish us. And I was saying earlier about how strategically I surround myself with highly manipulative people who love me, because I recognize that I'm gonna be my best self when I'm in their presence. Because they share my values and they won't let me get into my own bullshit. Right. And that's a huge thing. I mean, that's a huge value. Right. And it's hard, I think, when you're thinking about reinvention to say, well, maybe that reinvention involves I hang with different people because the people that I'm hanging with are not helpful to me in being the person that I want to be. Right. I mean, it's not something that we can just sort of squint really hard and think I want to do this really bad and then it's going to happen. It happens because our environment, and especially the people in our environment, either facilitate that or inhibit that. Yeah.
And I think all of the factors we've been talking about play, you know, the social environment reflects that back on us. So not only do those people promote certain behaviors, but they've categorized us in particular ways. And so if we actually have a category label with those people, then they see us as having essence of whatever it is. And now if we want to change, they're going to look at us and think, well, you can't change. You're not that person. You're this person. And that can actually undermine your motivation to want to change. And of course, not everybody necessarily wants you to change in the ways that you want to change, which means that you can get feedback from people in your environment that can chip away at your resolve to be different in the future. What you want are people who are supportive. And being supportive isn't just saying, yes, that's wonderful. It's also in the reactions that they have to the things that you're doing and the conversations that they have and their willingness to be there when the attempt at reinvention is going in a difficult way. Because the thing about reinvention isn't just, you know, if reinvention were easy, we'd all do it all the time. So it requires a lot of work, and there are lots of moments for everyone, moments of self-doubt. And in those moments, having someone else who says, no, you're doing great. You know, or this, I know this was a bad day, but look at how far you've come. Because we live in a time horizon that's actually fairly narrow. We can remember who we were like a month ago, and we can think forward about a month from now. But you know, think about it. I mean, can you really remember much about really who you were, say, 4 years ago? I mean, actually, for many of you, if you went 4 years ago, you'd be like, when exactly was that in my life? I mean, you could go back to the calendar, but really trying to think about, like, what was I doing 4 years ago? That's actually really hard. And so having people who can remember you, who you were and where you've come to be is extraordinarily powerful as a part of this process, which is why it can be it, with people who are willing to be supportive, can be incredibly valuable to have people around you.
It just reminds me, we just moved into a new house and my daughter went away for camp. And she came back 2 weeks later and she looked at the counter in the kitchen and there was a knife container, you know, like a wood block with knives in it. And she looked at it and she said, when did you become that person? I was like, what is that person exactly?
A William Sonoma
organized
person.
Yes. So I'm that person now, whatever that is. So I want to talk a little bit about risk before we open it up for questions, because the psychology of risk goes into this as well. You know, how much do we risk losing our old self? How much does the fact of who we were play a part in what we can become? And what is risk when we're talking about risk in psychology?
All I can think about now with risk is this cutting block with the knives on it.
That's right. This is me. I'm this person.
I know. Exactly. You know, I think we are understandably risk averse. I mean, generally, I mean, some people are sort of titillated by the idea of risking something that would be interesting. But I think most of us, especially when it comes to who we are and how we conceive of ourselves, find risky propositions not necessarily attractive, and for good reason, right? Because risk has the possibility of something going wrong and something being actually worse. And Art, who runs the Human Dimensions of Organizations program at the university, which he created, I mean, one of the things you understand is that making any change has risks associated with it. And one of the reasons that many people are loath to make changes is that the possibility is it could be worse. And I have to get into at least one Daryl Royal quote relation to this, is that back in the 70s, when Texas actually won football games, it was the most boring football that anybody could ever watch, because what Daryl Royal did is recruited all these huge linemen and these huge running backs, and they would just pummel people getting from whatever they started to the end zone. And he never passed the ball. He just never passed the ball. I mean, a quarterback for Daryl Royal was somebody who hands off the ball to a running back. That was what they were for. And somebody asked Daryl Royal in a press conference once, said, Coach Royal, why don't you ever pass the ball? And he said, because only three things can happen when you pass the ball, and two of them are bad. That's pretty astute, isn't it? I mean, that's why we pay coaches $7 million. So I'm not bitter. One of the things, though, about risk is that risk has the potential for loss, right? Risk has the potential that the situation will be worse after taking a chance than not. But I think what happens over the span of you know many years of one's life is you realize that, you know, when I take risks, what's the frequency with which the risk pays off and which the frequency with risk doesn't? And all of us have different experiences with that, right? And so everybody's tolerance of risk varies based not on just whatever genetic predispositions they have, which is certainly part of it, but also what their experiences have been with taking risks and what the outcomes have been. So when we're thinking about the risk of actually redefining myself and trying to think about now being seen by myself and by other people as somewhat different than the way I'm seen and the way I see myself right now, there's a possibility that it would be worse. And that's something to balance when I'm making decisions about how much effort I'm willing to put into doing something like that.
And it actually becomes really important in that context then to take those risks seriously and actually ask yourself first, what's the worst thing that could happen? And then how likely is that? Now, yeah, you might say, well, obviously you should ask that question, but it's actually stunning how rarely people do that explicitly. Because a lot of times what holds us back is a general fear of the unknown without actually really thinking through what's the worst thing that could happen. Because often in these cases of reinvention, the worst case isn't really that bad. You know, I mean, and so giving yourself that freedom to say, oh, actually, you know, I mean, so for example, people are afraid of public speaking. How many, I was going to say by show of hands, but there's a dark room. I'm just going to assume a bunch of hands would
and
go up.
It's
if
radio,
I said, who
so,
would be, that's
you know,
right.
I mean,
all of you,
no
if
point.
If you're listening to this while driving, please don't raise your hands. Okay, so, but I mean, we've said on previous shows that public speaking is enough of a fear for people that we routinely use it as a stress manipulation in experiments in psychology. You can get a reliable increase in stress hormone production by telling someone you're about to get up and give a speech in front of experts who are going to evaluate you. The thing about public speaking, though, is what's the worst thing that could happen? I mean, really, is that you give a bad talk in front of a bunch of people that you probably will never see again. And if you do see them, they're probably not going to point you out in public to everyone and say, that's the one who gave that terrible talk. So in fact, the worst case scenario isn't so bad. And at some point, if you get up and give a few talks, internalizing the fact that actually there's a lot of great things that can happen when you give talks to people and very few really horrible ones, that fairly soon you actually stop being afraid of public speaking. And so, you know, really thinking through what's the worst that can happen is an incredibly important part of this process.
Yeah. You know, I just think, you know, risk in general, not just related to the idea of reinvention, but the idea of taking on risk. You know, we are very comforted by routines because our lives are predictable. And to take that away, you know, to take the predictability away, is stress producing, understandably, right? But I think the thing we have to think about, and I bring this up a lot when we're talking about issues like this, is evolutionarily why that would be a thing. You know, why would hominids evolve that the idea of uncertainty is anxiety producing, right? Why would I be wary about that? And if you think about it, you know, there are lots of reasons in, you know, early humans, you know, on the savanna, and there's a cave and it's dark and there might be food in there or there might be a saber-toothed tiger. It's to my advantage to be risk averse, right? But if I'm giving a speech, we didn't evolve for this. You know, we don't know about this. Our basic limbic system and the things that we respond to in terms of fear and stress and anxiety evolved for threats that were genuine threats to existing, right? And now all that whole system that evolved to keep us alive so we could propagate our genes is still operating because there's four goober experts in the room and I'm supposed to give a speech. And all that stuff comes flooding to the fore, even though it didn't evolve for this, right? And as Art's saying, what's the worst that can happen? These four goobers who don't look too impressive as I'm looking at them, they're going to think poorly of me. Who gives a damn? I don't know these people. But all that stuff that's deeply embedded in not my cognitive thinking reasoning part, but in the part of my brain that just responds to the environment is now coming into play, even though it doesn't make any sense to do that.
And so before we let Rebecca ask her next question or take questions or whatever it is that's next, I want to come back to Bob's birthday.
Oh, good God.
Yay! On a day like today for Bob, it was probably a good day for him to do some reflection on his life and the state of his life. And on days like birthdays or significant holidays, we do this on New Year's every year, these are times where we really often look back over where we were and look forward to where we want to be. Now, why is it that these landmarks have such a powerful influence on our lives? And the big reason is that life is, generally speaking, too busy to contemplate too much. You know, we're constantly going to the next thing. We have work to do or events to do. Our schedule is busy. Maybe we have kids that we have to take care of. And so most of life is just about trying to keep relatively on schedule. And so having these landmarks in our lives, whether it's a birthday or New Year's or something like that, provides this opportunity to ask, how am I doing? Right? Am I feeling good with where I am? Is there something that I was hoping to achieve that maybe I haven't yet achieved?
Rockstar.
There you go. And this leads to one other piece to this, which we haven't talked about in a while, which is all the research on regret. And just to remind everybody that you know, if you ask college students what they regret, they generally regret dumb things they did. But if you ask people who are older in their 70s, 80s, and 90s what they regret, they almost universally regret the things they didn't do rather than the things that they did do. And the reason that this is so powerful is because on those landmarks, on your birthday, on New Year's, it is time to ask yourself, you can play this game. The brain is remarkable. It gives you this opportunity for mental time travel. Project yourself to the end of your life and ask yourself, what haven't I done that I think I would regret not having done? And then do it. And that's where actually the saxophone came from, was thinking, well, someday I would regret never having learned to play the saxophone. And most other people now regret having heard me play the saxophone, but that's a whole different issue. But then, you know, to do that at a time where you actually have the opportunity to make some kind of change. So on those landmarks, I mean, take advantage of those days. I mean, we, you know, a lot of people are like, well, let me brush this off. I don't even want to pay attention to the fact that another year went by. But no, actually grasp that and use it as a chance to really think about where you are. Yeah.
So okay, before we open it up for questions, what's the riskiest thing you've ever done? Go. Risky
clothed.
Thing.
Legal things or
doesn't have to be legal. It's okay. I could edit that out.
What's the worst thing that could happen?
I think I can safely say in a deliberately ambiguous way that I was not a risk-averse teenager.
Okay. In the 60s.
The end. The end.
What about you, Art?
Beyond what Bob said. That's a good question. I think it was probably telling my mom in college that I was not going to pursue the career path that she had envisioned for me. But in part because you grow up in a particular environment in which there are ways you're supposed to think about your future, and to kind of make it clear, no, I mean it was this moment actually of making it clear, no, I'm now officially not living the life that my parents laid out for me, which was risky, partly as a way of redefining an important relationship, and partly as a way of saying, oh no, it's all on me from here on out.
Yeah. Well, we're glad that you took that risk. There you go. So let's open things up for questions. Amy's coming around with a mic. Just raise your hand. There's a question right here in the front. Feel free to not ask a question if you don't want to.
Thanks, Amy.
Okay, so when is a time...
Oh, wait, one second. Is it on?
Is it on?
Yep. There we go.
When is it a time that you should be content with yourself and not try to reinvent yourself? Because at this time in my life, I'm not ready for risks.
Yeah. Yeah. So... Tell me the first part of your question again.
So when is it a time that you should be content with yourself
and accept yourself.
Not try to... reinvent yourself.
I'm very much into self-contentment. I really am, and I have to
content.
Tell you,
I meant content.
Yeah, no.
Not content, but content.
Right. Content. Yeah. I got it. Now, pardon me. I'm old. I can't hear anything. But here's the thing. I think you know. I think our society overstrives. You know, I mean, I think I was just telling...
I'm not sure anyone's ever said that better.
Yeah. You know, we were back in the back before we came out here. You know, what I think about is, you know, I love being my age, mostly because I'm not trying to get anything. And when I was younger, you know, I thought... I got to get promoted, you know, I got to get the job, I got this thing, you know. And I realize now as an old person that all of that was unnecessary, you know. If I just focused on doing the things that I enjoyed and I was good at and I was productive and all that would have happened anyway, you know. So I think the idea about becoming comfortable with yourself is one of the most important things that any human being can do. I think, you know, we have all kinds of things in media that tell us we ought to be something other than what we are. I think that's poisonous. You know, I just think Gwyneth Paltrow is the enemy of contentment.
And gynecology.
That's right. Here comes UT Legal again. But
there's line forming, Ron.
But I think the idea that, you know, you should want to be something other than you are is so insidious. Because, you know, I mean, really what if you look at the things that, as Art was saying, you know, people approaching the most mature parts of their lives, the ends of their lives, say, what are you really happy about? Almost all of it has to do with other people. You know, with your interactions with other people, that you increase the well-being of other people, either because you were kind to them or you took care of them or you contributed something to their lives. That's what people care about. And all of the public measures of what's valuable ignore all of that. You know, it's rock star, or it's you've gotten some accolade for some professional thing that you've done. And, you know, all of those things, and again, I say this from an old person's perspective, are fleeting and transient. And the things that really maintain and sustain human beings are their interactions with other people and the contributions you make to other people's lives. And one of the reasons that I'm so happy with myself, you know, is that I interact with people all the time. And in my arrogance, I think, you know what? I made their lives a little better. You know, I was nice to them. I taught them something. I did something. And I think that thing, that thing about the other, you know, making somebody else feel better, be better, do better, whatever. I mean, that thing is what survives in most people's long-term perceptions of what they've done.
Yeah, and just to add one piece to this. So there's a distinction that psychologists make often between intrinsic rewards and extrinsic rewards, which basically come down to, do I enjoy doing this, or do I do this because there's something out there I'm going to get because I do it? And one of the things we know about people who are generally content with what's going on in their lives is that they spend a reasonable amount of time in their life doing things that are intrinsically enjoyable for them, whatever that happens to be. And if you are lucky enough to live a life where most of the things you do are really satisfying, keep doing that. And don't let people tell you from the outside, but if you had this, things would be so much better. Because if they're already really good, go with that.
Yeah.
Okay?
All right, look at that. Yes.
Stay there.
I'm going to stop there.
There are a couple more questions. I don't know where Amy is, but I see some hands.
There's a hand back
there. There we go.
Hi.
Hello.
I don't know, where are you? Who are you?
I'm back here next to these gurus. So my question is, could you speak to, you were speaking about labels and labels that people put on themselves. But my question is, there's a lot of cultural biases with labels. And so if you're seeking a label that, you know, your environment, your cultural environment is against, what advice would you give to someone trying to overcome that?
That's a great question. Well, you know, I think part of the thing about cultural biases is that we don't sort of choose those, right? And we don't choose the people who convey those biases to us. And if you think about all of the circles, the concentric circles of people who influence our lives, we were just talking about this before we came out today, about, you know, who's in your family, who's your neighbors, who are strangers, you know. But I mean, even to make it stronger than that, who are the people whom you really trust? And you think, that person, I trust that they know a lot of things that are important, and I trust that person. Then you start to form a hierarchy of whose labels you come to value, right? I mean, it's interesting to me that all of us are conceived of by different people in different ways, you know? I mean, Art and our college professors, you know, were liberal, pinko, weirdo Austinites, you know, who teach at the university. And so everybody has little different ways of labeling different people, you know. But I think the question that all of us need to ask ourselves is, what is the small number of people, who are those people who we allow to tell us who we are? Right? I mean, for many people, they never make that decision consciously. And like, how they perceive themselves is based on whoever they happen to bump into, you know, or whoever makes a comment on social media or something. Well, who the hell are they? And I would tell you, I have two criteria for people who get to give me feedback that I take seriously. One is, they actually have to honest to God care about me. And the other one is, they have to honest to God know what the hell they're talking about, right? Now, this is seriously, because like, professionally, my mother, who used to read all of my research articles, and I know didn't understand a lot of them, but she enjoyed reading them, and she loves me, but she doesn't know what the hell she's talking about the research articles. So she would say, this is brilliant, you know, and I felt good, right? And there are other people who tell me things, who know a lot, but they don't care about me. And the thing is, when it comes to decisions about those kinds of things, I have to have the combination of those two things, right? Now, my mother knows a lot about other things, and I give her complete credence on that, right? And I have some professional colleagues who know a lot about things, who care about me, who will tell me that, you know, that thing right there, that wasn't very good. And I actually listen to them, right? Because I know, not only do they know what they're talking about, but that they actually care enough about me to tell me the truth, right? And we typically don't make conscious decisions about who those people are, right? It's just like whoever bumps into our, you know, social sphere, and now we start paying attention to them. Why would you pay attention to them? Who the hell are they, right? Do they meet those criteria? And if they don't, I probably shouldn't pay attention to them. Once you develop a list, you know, the small group of who these people are, now there's a consistency in your life, because those people, because they care about you, because they know what the hell they're talking about, they tend to stay on the same track. And now that part of your life is predictable, because you've got this small group of people who meet those criteria, and they don't vacillate with whatever trends are coming down the pike, right? They are dependable in the sense of their caring and their knowledge of what's going on.
Yes. We have time for about two more questions. Okay.
Where are you, Amy?
Okay. Ready? Oh, hey. Ooh, hello. Sorry, my question might be a little complicated because it involves a little short story. Short story. Relax.
Clock is ticking. Get going.
Damn. I was sitting in a place like this, but maybe five times as big, and Jean-Pierre Jeunet, the director of Amelie, said, "If you want to be a director, stop. If you want to make films, you're in the right place." So that changed my life, and now I call myself a filmmaker. But I'm probably, when I make more films and I'm more established, I'll start saying I make films. Because calling myself a filmmaker is more like a projection. In my head, during the talk, I imagined going up to Art Markman and talking to him about the class I took with him 10 years ago. And I thought I would call him Professor Markman, and then eventually he would tell me, "Call me Art."
No, because he still makes me call him Professor Markman.
Okay.
Dr. Markman.
Anyway.
I'm sorry, I wrecked your flow. I'm sorry.
It's fine. Another little tidbit. I couldn't consider myself a visual artist, but I stopped because I had the pressure of being a good visual artist to everybody. So I was frozen in my development psychologically. But then at 28, when I was like, I've always wanted to learn piano, I was able to. And now I'm probably better at music than I am at art. Oddly enough, I learned the Amelie soundtrack on piano. But I want to take it to a mental illness, sort of like when we label people with mental illnesses, which I have, bipolar 2. And if you know anything about, because I was speaking to a psychiatrist recently and I dismissed him because he could not break through the archetype of, like, in this relationship between authority and patient. He couldn't do it. He couldn't take me being a human being. He just saw that I was manic weeks before he saw that I was depressed. So he labeled me in front of my face. So I left. So do you know anything about, maybe alternative approaches to, like, psychiatry and mental illness, and the old saying that, like, it's no sign of good health to be well-adjusted to a sick world, and... Do you know who Artie Lang is and what he has to say? Is that relevant? Blah, 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 blah.
Okay, so you can call me Art, by the way.
I still, however, call him Dr. Markman.
I think you raise an interesting point. I mean, diagnoses in general, and diagnoses specifically when they surround mental illness, carry an essence with them, and create a set of perceptions in people around you that your behavior is going to conform to a particular set of preconceived ideas. And I think that one of the things that's important is to try to keep track of what am I doing, And the actions are both actions that you're taking as well as the sort of mental actions that are visible primarily to you, and be focused on those behaviors as much as the label itself. Because I think that whenever you categorize anything, one of the things that you do is to begin to bring that thing closer to the ideal or sometimes the prototype of that thing. So for example, if I label something as being red, in my memory, it becomes closer to real kind of good fire engine red than it probably was in real life. So the way I interpret it moves closer to that ideal. And I think the same thing happens when you have people who've labeled someone as having a particular mental illness. And I think that one of the things that you want to do is to really be focused on, what am I doing? What are the actions that I'm taking, and internally, you know, how does that feel? And be much more focused on that than focused on, I have this label that's going to keep dragging me back towards that ideal categorization.
Yeah. One more question. Yeah. Oh, there's Amy.
So my question has to do with, can you get benefit with your subconscious mind by listening to certain affirmational, you know, statements, you know, while you're sleeping? And can you speak to, on the same vein, like in a metaphysical Christian way, pray as and believe that you have already received?
Well, I a couple of things about the self-affirmation thing. I'm not sure how much you actually get when things are playing when you're asleep, because you're asleep. And for a long time, there was a thought that, you know, you could sort of access things that were happening while your brain was actually in a sleep state, but we tend to know that's generally not the case. But I do want to say about self-affirmation when you're conscious and when you're not just hearing something, but more importantly, saying things yourself. We human beings underestimate the power of verbal rehearsal. We know this in all dimensions of human interaction, right? Practicing saying and thinking things makes them more real. It would be, we tend not to think because we're sophisticated human beings and we're logical and all that kind of stuff. Well, not so much actually. And because we can actually change our perception of the veracity of an idea by rehearsing it, right? That is both, you know, a positive if it's used for positive ends, and it's a potential negative when it's used for negative ends, right? So if you think about for yourself, if you have some self-perception that is debilitating in some way, you know, you're down on yourself, you have negative impressions of yourself, and you rehearse those things, one way to help yourself out of that is not to say, stop saying that. Because it's almost impossible to cease a behavior without replacing it with something else, right? You can't just say, stop it. And any of us who's trying to do that know how impossible that is. So what do? Well, you replace it with something that's incompatible with that, right? So rather than saying, you know, how crappy you are and how nobody likes you and that kind of thing, you start saying things that are more affirmative about you and what your potential is and those kinds of things. And that's not just BS. I mean, that actually has an effect on our beliefs and actually has an effect on the way we behave potentially. I mean, it's really pretty amazing, right? But I think for us to take action to do that, the first thing that has to happen is you have to recognize in yourself that what I say will influence the way I feel. And we typically think of it as the opposite. You know, I feel a certain way and then stuff comes out of me when I talk. And what I need to do to change that is I need to somehow get inside there and change what I think. But actually, the verbalizations are the mechanism for changing what you think.
And I just want to say a couple of words on the topic of prayer. And there's, because I think that in the context of reinvention, there's a few elements to this that are important. One is that many people have difficulty reinventing themselves or changing behaviors because they engage in a cycle of negative thoughts about themselves and they just can't get out of that. And prayer, one of the modes of prayer is a very meditative mode. And the advantage of that kind of meditation is that it provides you with this opportunity to actually pay attention to that running monologue inside of your head, which can allow you to recognize, oh, I'm doing it again. I've gotten into that cycle of thoughts, which can then actually create an opportunity to try to break out of that. And say, you know what? I don't need to talk myself out of doing this. So you can actually break that, and that can be. So there's an element of prayer that can be very valuable. And I'll give you another valuable one, and then a not so valuable one. The other valuable one is that there are also times where you just don't have the energy anymore to keep doing the thing that you've tried to do, and. Many people who've tried to change behavior of one sort or another have reached that breaking point where you're just like, you know, I just can't do this anymore. And I'm going to, you know, have that cigarette or take that drink, or I'm just going to give up on school altogether or whatever it is. And in those moments, you may not feel comfortable enough with another human being on planet Earth who will say to you, you know what, you really can do it. And in those moments, prayer is also something that can be really valuable because it creates a way of externalizing, getting outside of yourself what is at present just inside of yourself. And so whether you believe in that there's a God listening to your prayers, it still can be really helpful to get it out because it provides this way of stepping back and saying, wait a second, I think maybe I can do this after all. And so that's another benefit of prayer. Now, here's the place where it may not be so good. We've talked several times today about this idea of a bridgeable gap. The gap matters. The gap creates energy. There are times where people pray in order to feel better about what's going on right now in a way that where you think, well, I'm being taken care of. And if you create in yourself that sense that somebody's looking out for me, one of the things that does psychologically is it narrows the gap. And in some moments, narrowing the gap can be useful. When you're feeling utterly overwhelmed by life, actually narrowing that gap is great because what it says is, okay, I can't do anything about it right now. I'm so over-energized, I can't get anything done. I just need a moment of calm and peace. But calm and peace never got anything done. And so at some point, you have to stop feeling that somebody else is taking care of you and seize control of the energy that's going to allow you to get things done. And in that moment, you can't pray that somebody's taking care of you. You actually have to accept that there's a gap between present and future and work towards bridging that gap. And there are times where I think people can create mechanisms, whether it's through prayer or some other practice that gives them feelings of contentment that allow them to continue on not doing anything when deep down they know they ought to be doing something.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, I think that's a good place to end.
Wait. Just a second. Because we just brought up the idea of other people taking care of you. And I think we have to say, Two Guys Are in Your Head is now in its fifth year on public radio and podcasts. And, you know, Art and I do most of the talking on the air, so it seems like we're the show. Actually, Rebecca McEnroy is the show.
gold out of gold.
As Art likes to say, sometimes you hear an edited version of the show, and it's like Rebecca made a ransom note. She took one word and then put another word together and made sentences that seem like Art and I know what we're talking about. And she does that week in and week out. And the reason this thing exists is because of her. And we're all very fortunate to have her doing that.
That is very kind. Thank you. But you're not going to get off that easy, because it is Bob's birthday. So before we go, everybody, happy birthday to you.
Thank you all very much. Good night. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming out. Please pick up a t-shirt on your way out. They're there until supplies run out. And have a wonderful evening. Thank you for coming out.
You've been listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas, for KUT Radio. You'll find a complete archive of all of our Views and Brews in the iTunes store or go to KUT.org for more information. Thanks for listening.